Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
This is John Christopher for Real Life, and today I have as my guest, Melissa Green of Melissa Green Designs. Hi, Melissa. How are you today?
Hi, John. I'm great, thank you.
You look great, by the way.
Thank you.
So before we talk about how you can enhance a home interior, let's start back at the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in England, in the south of England. Moved to London when I was 10.
I can hardly hear any accent.
You can't hear an accent?
No.
A lot of people can't. My English friends all think that I sound American.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So when you go back to visit sometimes, they think that.
Totally. Yeah. But I've been here 22 years now.
Right. Right.
So I was in England. And then when I was 18, I moved to Italy. Fell in love with Italy.
Wait a second. 18? You just said, I'm tired of England. I'm going to Italy. And
yeah.
That's it?
Yeah.
That's,
I just wanted to travel.
Love it.
I had a thirst for some European adventure. So, yeah, I moved over when I was 18. I was supposed to go for 3 months, and I ended up spending 3 years living in Florence.
Wow.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm.
So did you study art there? Or?
I did. I studied art history, and I studied Italian. I studied how to cook. I studied how to meet Italians, and
well, isn't
had a great
it
life.
The other way, you're beautiful, so, I mean, that must have been easy, right? I mean, Italian guys just...
Not sure about that. They're dangerous.
Right.
Stay away from those naughty Italians.
Oh, is that right? My daughter has a thing that she wants. One of the she has the bucket list, and one of them is to ride on a moped or a little
Vespa.
A Vespa. Thank
yeah.
you. You know, with an Italian guy. So
I did that. Really fun.
Okay.
You can call me anytime.
Anytime. You can tell her what the experience is like. So I see that your interior design has been influenced. So we got to Italy. Did you go any other place after Italy?
No, I lived there for 3 years. Then I moved back to London. But I've always loved Europe. I love to travel. So I spend a lot of time in France, in Paris. My brother lives in Paris. So I've been there. And Europe is so easy to travel within. So each country is just so close. So when I was based in London, I would just go for weekends at all these different places. Yeah.
Wow.
And then since I've been here, I've traveled a lot down south, like South America. So Argentina, Mexico,
Colombia. Do you think
Colombia.
That's been influencing your perspective on your
interior? Definitely. Oh, for sure. Oh. Yeah.
I see the European thing going on, but
right.
the South American, I didn't.
Yeah, that's a new thing for me. It's more of the beachy thing, but yeah, it's I pull inspiration from all my travel, wherever it may be.
Right. So when you went back to England, is that when you were a European equity trader?
No, I was a European equity trader in New York. In fact, I moved here and I was planning to work in the art world because I studied art history. And I was working for a friend who was working in a bank, and I was just helping her on some little things. And suddenly the head trader one day asked me to be a trader on the desk. I thought he was kidding. I was like, yeah, right, funny. And he said, no, I'm serious. I want you to become a trader. So I did that for 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was it stressful?
Very. Yeah. Really crazy. I had to get up at 4 a.m. and I would work until 1. Then I would...
Wait a second. 1 a.m?
No, I'd get to work at 4 a.m. I'd work till 1 p.m. because I was working European hours.
European time.
Yeah.
Right.
So I had to be in work when Helsinki opened. So I had to be there at 4 a.m. and I'd work till 1, and then I would sleep from like 2 till 5. And then I would be up, like have a normal evening from like 6 to 11, and then go to bed again from 11 till 4.
What a wonderful life.
That's Winston Churchill. He slept twice a day.
Did he really? I didn't know that.
He did.
Well, see, you learned something. Now, you speak also, you speak obviously 4 languages, English, which you're speaking now, French.
Right.
Italian. And and what's the other one?
I speak some Spanish.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question. What do you dream in?
What do I dream in?
Yeah, what language?
I dream in American.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was talking to somebody the other day and who's from Spain, and she was born in Spain, but she lives here now. She's an artist. And she says she goes back and forth.
Really?
You know, between Spanish and English.
Interesting.
In her dreams. And I thought that was fascinating. That's why I asked the question.
Yeah.
Anyway. So you describe or you define your style as uptown beach chic, right? With a downtown feel?
Yeah. Well, that is what I feel.
You feel it. So expand on that.
Well, I think my design, my style is really a sophisticated environment. Like, it's sophisticated, relaxing, eclectic, but yet relevant. So you've got a little city thing going on, but yet it's all relaxed and comfortable, but good quality and just stylish.
Especially like your designs in kitchens. I mean, it seems like they're very colorful. They've got it's not the typical white kitchen.
Right.
It's eye-catching. So does color play any part in your designs?
It does, for sure. I mean, I tend to like natural colors. Like, I like to bring the colors of nature inside. So I tend to work with that palette, a neutral palette. But then in terms of color, as most people would consider color, I like to get through fruit, flowers, books, artwork. Mm. So I like to have a neutral palette and then just add to it. And then you can change according to your mood, your season, that type of thing.
And change it. So you don't have to have the same looking room.
You're not committed to a color, exactly.
Wow. Yeah. That's very unique. Palette. So how do you build a relationship with a client? How does that go about? How do you go about that, I should say?
The key is to listen. And it really is. I don't approach my clients with this is what you need to do. I like to listen to what they want to do and to really guide them towards their vision. And a lot of people are scared. They don't think they have a vision. They're like, you do it. You pick it all. I was like, no, what do you like? So I really like to just elicit it from them and communicate and just hear what they want to do. And the key is timeline and budget. And a lot of people have no idea how to put that together. So I'm very practical.
So how does that work, though? I mean, like you say, budget and timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Do you say to them, okay, let's get this together. Okay, let's just use an example. Somebody just bought a house. Okay, it's has no furniture in it. And they say, Melissa, come in here and design it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you say to them, look, I'll have this done within a month. I'll have it done within...
Yeah, I go through all the details of what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I work out how long it's going to take. And then I tend to add a month to it. But I'm very, very realistic because everything takes longer than you think.
That seems to be the case, especially out here.
No question. But what I do have a tough time with, and I'm working with some clients right now who have a July 20th deadline because they invited guests.
And they want it all ready.
So we have to go do this crazy rush project. Just because they've invited guests, which it scares me because I don't want to compromise the quality of the job and just to pull things in last minute, which are maybe not so good looking, but they'll do just to have a deadline like that. If it's a wedding or something that really makes sense, I get
then
that.
It's doable,
but, yeah.
Right.
But so.
Have you ever done something and the client says, you know what? It doesn't work for me, or that room doesn't necessarily work for me, or that's never happened. It's because you...
It's never happened.
Oh.
John, come on. No, but you know, it's definitely, it's a work in progress, and I like to work very much with people. So if they have like two items that they love, then what we do is we'll work a room around it. So I tend to get everything approved by my clients.
Wonderful. Melissa, how can somebody get in contact with you to employ your gifted talent?
Oh, they can go on my website, which is melissagreendesign.com. That's green like the color. And
easy
very
enough.
Easy to contact me, for sure.
And they get to see some of the beautiful work that you do.
Yeah,
right?
It needs a little updating, but it's good.
Yeah, I think it's fabulous.
Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. This is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with my next guest. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and today I have with me Sag Harbor Village Mayoral candidate Kathleen Mulcahy. Before we get into some of your ideas and some of the issues that you want to deal with, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I am the mother of two children, Coleman and Carrie. They both went through the entire Sag Harbor school system and then went on to different colleges. Coleman played Division I baseball at Delaware, and my daughter is a junior at Northwestern University.
Right, and Coleman was fantastic. What's he doing with the baseball? Still doing
He's
that?
Coaching baseball.
Oh,
he's
he is.
Actually going to be coaching for the Bulldogs this summer, the Bulldogs baseball camp in East Hampton.
That's wonderful.
Yep.
Now, you've been in Sag Harbor for how long?
Been in Sag Harbor for 24 years. Actually, when Coleman was born, I had come out to East Hampton my entire life. And when Coleman was born, we went to find our own place. And the only place we could afford at that point was Sag Harbor. So that shows you how much has changed.
That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you. So you've seen a change. Do you think it's changed for the good or for the bad?
Oh, I think 85% for the good.
Good.
It's wonderful. You know, the houses.
There's no place like it, right?
Yeah. The houses are beautiful. A lot of money has been spent in that town. The main street is the hoppinest place in all of the East End. It is the only place that when we moved to Sag Harbor, we were just doing summers and weekends. When 5 years later, we decided to move out year round, it's the only place I would have lived year round.
Right.
And it's wonderful. The school system, we've seen that improve tremendously. My daughter went through the IB program, and that's why she's at Northwestern on pretty much a full scholarship.
Wow.
So it's wonderful.
That's so fabulous. Yeah. It's great. Your kids are great. You know, you're great. I have to ask you, what prompted you to want to run?
So 2 years ago, I went in to vote for the trustees and the mayor, and I was really upset to see that she was running unopposed. And Mayor Schroeder has done a decent job over the years, but no one should run unopposed. It's just bad for democracy. And I feel like because she ran unopposed, she then this year and the year before got a little bit more my way or the highway. And I just, a few months ago, couldn't stand the idea that no one else was going to run. So we were at a dinner party, and we were telling this to Cindy Morris, a woman who ran for Brookhaven Village Clerk and is very involved in the Democratic Party in Suffolk County. And she asked us at the dinner party, well, why isn't someone running? And they went around the table, and by the time they got to me, they all had an excuse of one set or another. By the time they got to me, everybody was sort of like, you don't have any of our excuses, and you'd be really good. And I said, oh, don't be ridiculous. And then I went home that night, and I started thinking, and I thought, you know, I know what I feel is wrong with this this village, and I started talking to people, and they all agreed that many of the issues that I had were the issues they had, and they're issues that I can solve. We need a long-term, comprehensive strategic plan for Sag Harbor.
I have to agree with that because I used to be on the Harbor Committee, and it always seems to me that it's kicking the can down the road. It's like, okay, it's never addressing what the problem is at that time. And then all of a sudden, there's the problem, you know, maybe a couple of years down the line, but there it is.
Precisely. And that happens in the Harbor Committee. It happens in the ARB. It happens in the Zoning Board. It happens in the Board of Trustees. It is a reactive set of boards, not a proactive one.
Right.
And there have been a lot of changes in Sag Harbor. As I say, 85% good. 15% a little scary. You know, I don't think our kids are ever going to be able to live there.
Right. Can't afford it.
Not absolutely. And they are just, and the water is not as clean and pristine as it once was, and the beaches aren't as beautiful as they once were. And there are changes, and the changes are going to keep on coming fast and furiously.
And somebody
and
has
we
to be on
need
top.
To prepare. Yeah, yeah we need right. to be prepared for that.
I know Havens Beach, when I was there, was an issue, and it still is today.
It is.
It hasn't changed.
And it's actually gotten worse because of the dredging.
Right.
And again, just if we had, not only do we need this strategic plan, but we need a village administrator to help make sure that this plan happens. And again, we need it on a holistic basis, because doing one-offs as we do now with consultants is not good enough. We needed somebody there when we did that dredging next to Long Wharf to say, but you can't put all that onto Haven's Beach without having a cleanup plan. But nobody did. They just put it on the first thing they saw.
Right, right. You know, another issue that I, because I work in the village, is that the parking, it hasn't changed. It's, if anything, it's gotten worse. I mean, is there anybody have any solutions here? It's, you know, and I'm sure there could be.
There are lots of solutions. It's the right solution that we're looking for.
Right.
There is a lot of parking. Now, it's hard for the, it's hardest probably for the workers in Sag Harbor, because there's not a lot of long-term parking.
Right.
And you can't park outside your office and have to move your car every 2 hours. So that is without a doubt a problem, especially as we're coming into summer where we've all gotten a little lax about parking. Now it's suddenly on fast and furiously, and it is a problem. But there is a plenty of parking if people are willing to walk. So number one, we've got to have our sidewalks better and better lit. We've got to have signs that tell people coming into Sag Harbor where there are parking areas, more signs. And then we do have to start looking about what it would mean to put parking meters in, or to do something dramatic like that. Not something everybody's going to like, but it may be where we need to go, especially with the theater coming in, because once that cinema opens, we're going to have easily 200 more cars on a Saturday night in Sag Harbor.
Yep.
Assuming it's successful, which we all, of course,
right.
hope it will be.
Right. That's amazing. I know. What do you think about the Long Wharf? I mean, there's the issue again. This goes back how many years, right?
Yep. We have to fix it. We have to do something. And then we have to look about what it, once it's fixed, just structurally, then we have to think about what it is. And that's, again, part of this holistic planning mm-hmm. idea, is that we don't want to decide what to do on Long Wharf until we decide what we're doing in parking in general, because one could affect another dramatically.
Right. That's so true. Kathleen, how can somebody, I know the election's coming up on Tuesday, was that June?
Tuesday, June 18th.
18th, you know, I think everybody should go out there and vote. You
at
know?
The firehouse on Brick Kiln from noon to 9 p.m.
Right. And, you know, I think that's great. If somebody wants to help you in your campaign before then, is there some place where they can be volunteers or donate?
They can. They can go on Mulcahy for Mayor, M-U-L-C-A-H-Y, FORMAYOR.com.
What is that again? Just
to MulcahyForMayor.com.
Okay.
There is a way to reach me. They can send me an email. I will respond as soon as I get it. And they can find out a lot more about the issues. They can also find out some important dates about absentee ballots and things like that.
Fantastic. Kathleen Mulcahy, it's been a delight having you on the program. This is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with my next guest, Andrew Lieb of Lieb at Law. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and today I have with me Andrew Lieb of Lieb at Law. Andrew, how are you?
I'm amazing, John. How you doing, my man?
You're always amazing, Andrew, because you always have a plethora of information that just blows me away every time. Today, I thought we could talk about something that you haven't spoken about in a long time. I think we're into hurricane season now.
That storm front's coming, John.
It's coming. Isn't there a song?
It's coming.
Didn't Billy Joel do a song called Storm Front?
I think he did. He heard it on the radio. That's where we are, so we're good.
This is perfect. This is ideal. So one of the things before we start, and you got it. So one of the things, what are the essential terms of a transaction? Let's refresh our memories here.
So from a broker's perspective, the courts of the state of New York say that there's 8 essential terms that a broker should negotiate. The first one being the price of the transaction. The second one being the time of payment, meaning when is money coming in. That could be before contract, on contract, etc. The next one's the terms of payment. Is it refundable? Is it subject to something? The next one is the required financing. Then they get into what's called quality of title. Quality of title means what type of product are you delivering? Then they say adjustments, which is a very important one, closing date, and then the one you're going to, and I know where you're going from the beginning,
exactly.
Is called risk of loss, John, risk of loss, because what happens when that house doesn't appear the way you thought it was when you close?
Exactly. So what happens? Can a person back out of a deal and get can they get their deposit back?
Let me put it differently than your question.
Okay.
Does their attorney and broker have a brain? That's the real question here, because there's a risk of loss clause.
I don't have a comment on that one, but go ahead, continue.
Well, they should hire you as their broker. I don't know if everyone knows, but there's a famous real estate agent on the line with me right now, and his name is John Christopher. And what John would do when he was negotiating, as everyone knows, is that he understands that a client that's buying a piece of property that has a dock is buying it because the dock is going to be there on the date of closing. But, John, you know what's interesting? The courts say that it's just whether it's a material or immaterial damage, whether the buyer can get out if the dock's not there. So let me do that one more time. The default rule is if it's immaterial damage and a buyer is buying a place and the court determines it's immaterial, the buyer cannot cancel the deal. They can just get an abatement or a reduction on the purchase price based on the damage.
So,
but if alternatively, John, it's material, they can get out.
Huh. So what are you saying? You're saying that if the dock is gone, right, you go there to do a walkthrough, and all of a sudden the buyer says, wasn't there a dock here before? What happens?
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's why I said you need a good real estate agent like John Christopher, because what in the world does material or immaterial mean? I have no freaking idea. Do you know?
No, that's why you're here to tell us. You have
no
idea.
No one knows, really.
Well, who
so
decides?
I'm going to tell you how the court's going to deal with it.
Yeah, go ahead.
A judge does. A judge and a jury decides. But let me tell you how they're going to decide. They're going to do it just based on numbers. And they're going to say, is it a material part of the purchase price? But let's not go with guessing and figuring and doing everything else. You know what a smart broker does, a smart attorney does when they collaborate? You need a team that collaborates like you and I.
Right.
What they do is they say in the contract of sale, a predominant material aspect of this deal is that the dock will remain in substantially similar condition on the date of closing, absent reasonable wear and tear. So we've defined what material means. And by defining it, you don't have ambiguity. If you were to instead just leave it as the default rule, maybe the place is worth $14 million. Maybe the dock's only worth $300,000. Is that material to $14 million? I don't think so. So the problem with valuations is you don't know the subjective valuation. It's an objective measure when you deal with the default rule. So what we really need to do is we need to define in the contract, in the negotiations, part of your negotiation needs to be, if you're a buyer's real estate broker, my client's buying this because they want the dock. And I don't know if anyone's ever dealt with trying to get a dock rebuilt when it's been destroyed.
Difficult.
Yeah, you're laughing.
Difficult.
You have a waterfront. You live on the water. You understand that by the time you're done with that, you're going to be in Kings Park Psychiatric Center, which they'll probably open up just for you. Because
right.
By the time you're done with that, you spent more money and more energy than you ever had. So the answer to your question, just summarizing it, is that the default rule uses these abstract terms. And smart attorneys and smart brokers should be speaking to their smart clients and figuring out why they're buying this house. Say, why do you want this house? And the person says to you and I used the example of a dock.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if they just said, the millworking over the fireplace is from 1800, that's why I want the house. If that's what they said, you should say, if the millworking is damaged in between contract and closing, absent ordinary wear and tear, that shall constitute a material damage to the property, giving rise to the risk of loss clause. And that's how you protect your clients. So I think a big thing, and this is something you and I emphasize a lot when we talk, these attorneys, these brokers that just go on autopilot and they use a one-size-fits-all approach, they are hurting their clients. You have to ask
Absolutely.
Questions.
Yep.
Because it's not about, John, what you want or what I want. It's what the client wants, right?
Yep. So let me.
I think that's essential.
Yep. I think, and it's very important to get somebody like yourself who's so knowledgeable about the law and knows about these things and actually cares about your client. And that's, I think, half the battle.
Not, it, I'm going to tell you, I do care about my client, but I care more about that when I go to Citarella's to go buy food, my client doesn't come up behind me with an ice pick and stab me in the jugular. I find that that's bad for eating your sandwich.
Absolutely.
So what happens is when they go to buy a house with a dock and there is no dock, and then they have to close anyway, and then they have to pay for the DEC, and they have to go through the wetlands and all the other jazz there, by the time they're done, they're going to become murderers.
Absolutely.
And I would rather not get murdered.
Right. I'm with you on that one. Now, let's look at the seller, right? He has insurance, or at least he thinks he does. What are some of the things, the pitfalls that could happen, you know, with insurance? Are there any things like...
I think the biggest pitfall, I jumped right in because I was hearing you say it, is that we live in a market where the insurance isn't going to cover unless you get excess insurance. Like, the amount that you're going to get with your flood insurance, unless you're getting... with just the baseline flood insurance, which, you know, is really a product that every insurance sells, but it's really from the federal government. You know, it's a FEMA
type of
thing that they go. If you don't go get an excess insurance and you're buying a $5 million place or a $10 million place, what's it going to cover? I'll give you a good illustration. I have a membership at a beach club in the Hamptons, and they have condos there, and I was going to go buy a condo, and I said to them, what's your insurance here? If it's on Dune Road. I said, what's your insurance here? If there's damage, they go, $10 million. I said, for $10 million, you're not even going to be able to clear the junk on this property. Like, the cost of properties in these expensive properties, people don't realize that insurance is great unless you don't have a high enough number. And
right.
The second question with insurance is, what's your deductible?
Right.
And then I think the third and most important thing is that a lot of these people, when they have insurance, and I don't know if this is exactly where you're going, but it's a pet peeve of mine, so I'm glad you asked. A friend of mine, he has this house, nice house, not in the Hamptons, it's in St. James. And my friend has this house, and he had this damage, this flood, because you're telling about storms, I'm thinking floods. And he hired a public adjuster, which I guess is good, bad, and different. And the public adjuster just went with what public adjusters do, and the insurance company disclaimed coverage because they said that the property was built that way from the beginning with the defects, and they said they didn't have to provide coverage.
Wow.
And I said to my friend of mine, I said, you know, we litigate this topic. We litigate with insurance companies. Why didn't you call me and not litigate it and start off with just saying, how do we make sure we get coverage? Because, and I mean this with no disrespect to insurance companies, but they're in the business of finding ways to disclaim coverage.
Absolutely.
And what you need to do is you need to make your claim proper. And I would say that's perhaps the biggest thing. So what happens is someone has a flood, as you and I were talking about, and then them and their Uncle Frank come over the next week, and they clear out all the damage. No one takes pictures.
Right.
No one notices the insurance company. You think they're going to pay for you?
Doesn't sound like it. Listen, I hate
to. It's a terrible thing.
It is a terrible thing, and I hate to cut you short here, Andrew. But
well, you got it. The storm's coming.
The storm's coming, and Andrew, we're going to have you back again. But how can someone get in touch with you in case they, you know, to avoid some problems in the future?
Well, I would love to hear from them. We have a easy phone number, 631-878-4455. But I'm going to tell you, the city folk get a set. They say that's a Suffolk County number. So you can call me at 646-216-8009 if you want to be an Up Island type of city type of person. We're glad to help you out. That's what we do.
Fantastic. Andrew Lieb at Lieb at Law. It's been a delight having you on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You have been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people, places, and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, broker associate with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life is also brought to you in part by Leap Compliance, HR's one-stop solution for sexual harassment prevention training and policies. All employers in the New York State are now required to train all employees annually, no matter the size of the company. For more information, discriminationpreventiontraining.com or 646-216-8038.